Part 1. Intuitive Theories of the Biological World. 2. Matter. What is the world made of? How do those components interact? When we watch a candle burn or a pot of water boil, we watch matter seemingly vanish into thin air. The wax disappears from the candlestick and the water disappears from the pot, but neither has truly vanished. They've just changed state, from visible wax to invisible carbon dioxide and water vapor, and from visible water to invisible steam. Matter may appear ephemeral, but it's actually indestructible. Chemists tell us that matter can be neither created nor destroyed, but common sense tells us that matter comes and goes, here one moment, gone the next. This common sense view of matter is held by people of all ages, but it is most easily demonstrated in children. You can demonstrate it for yourself if you know a preschooler who can serve as a test subject. Get two transparent containers, one tall and thin, and one short and squat. Fill the short, squat container half full of water and show the child. Then pour the water from the short, squat container into the tall, thin container and ask, "Is there now more water, less water, or the same amount of water as there was before?" The water column in the second container will be higher than it was in the first, so the child will probably claim that there is now more water. Transferring water from one container to another is all it takes to convince the child that you've performed an impossible feat. You've made more water. If you have ever taken an introductory psychology course, you may recognize this parlor trick as Piaget's conservation task. Jean Piaget was a Swiss psychologist who pioneered the study of child development in the early 1900s. He discovered several intriguing phenomena. Childhood realism, mistaking appearances for reality, childhood animism, attributing life to non-living entities, childhood artificialism, attributing human design to nature, and childhood egocentrism, assuming others know what you know. But the phenomenon he is best known for is conservation, or children's lack thereof. There are many versions of the conservation task, and young children fail them all. In another version, children are shown two equal-sized balls of clay and are asked to confirm that they contain the same amount of clay, have the same weight, and take up the same amount of space. If a child denies they do, he or she is asked to nullify the difference by moving pinches of clay from one ball to the other. One of the balls is then flattened into a pancake, and children are asked whether the two configurations of clay, the ball and the pancake, still contain the same amount of clay, conservation of mass, still have the same weight, conservation of weight, and still take up the same amount of space, conservation of volume. Preschoolers typically answer all three questions no, and elementary schoolers typically answer one or two questions no. Not until middle school do children reliably recognize that flattening a ball of clay does not change its mass, weight, or volume. Piaget's explanation for children's lack of conservation was that they have not yet acquired an operational logic of thought. He termed their thinking pre-operational, and he believed this type of thinking permeated all aspects of their mental life, not just their reasoning about conservation. Young children's inferences about physical causality and their evaluations of moral behavior were deemed pre-operational as well. Psychologists today no longer endorse the distinction between operational and pre-operational thought. They doubt Piaget's conclusions for a number of reasons, the most prominent of which is that children develop logical competence at different rates in different domains. For instance, children master the logic of natural language, grammar, and the logic of natural numbers, counting, before they enter school. But they master the logic of deductive reasoning, proofs, and the logic of proportional reasoning, fractions, only after a decade of formal schooling, if then. Even within the domain of conservation, children learn to conserve mass before they learn to conserve weight, and they learn to conserve weight before they learn to conserve volume. Conservation is not a unitary notion, acquired in full or not at all. It is a consequence of knowing whether specific transformations change specific properties of specific materials. Flattening a ball of clay will not change its volume, but heating it will. And heating a ball of clay will not change its weight, but sending it to the moon will. A lot of matter-specific knowledge is required to pass conservation tasks, which makes conservation an odd task for studying cognitive development in general. Following Piaget, developmental psychologists have conducted thousands of studies of conservation, but I doubt they would have studied conservation much at all if Piaget had not initially steered the field in that direction. Material phenomena are too mysterious and too varied to expect young children to instinctively know when material properties are conserved and when they are not. Matter is conserved across many transformations where it blatantly appears not to be. Water evaporating from an open container, steam escaping from a boiling pot, hot doors expanding in their frames, logs burning to ash. And many properties of matter are not conserved across transformations that conserve matter as a whole. The volume of water when frozen, the elasticity of a rubber band when stretched, the granularity of salt when dissolved, the viscosity of cake batter when baked. Preschoolers' belief that transferring water from a short, squat container into a tall, thin container increases the water's mass can hardly be classified as a logical error when the reality of material transformations is so opaque. To be fair, Piaget was interested in conservation not just as it pertained to matter, but as it pertained to quantities in general, including numerical quantities and spatial quantities. Rearranging a collection of toys does not change its number in the same way that squashing a ball of clay does not change its weight, and Piaget wanted to know when and how children grasped the necessity of that conclusion. Piaget's successors, on the other hand, were often captivated by conservation errors for a different reason. Those errors are incredibly persistent. Perhaps the most straightforward approach to correcting children's conservation errors is to instruct children to attend to multiple dimensions of a material transformation, say, the spread of water in a container and not just its height. But this kind of instruction has little effect on their errors, particularly if children are tested weeks or months later. In one study, several hundred children received one of four types of instructions on conservation. Some were provided with explicit feedback on their conservation judgments. Some were encouraged to make judgments before witnessing the relevant transformations. Some were shown how those transformations could easily be reversed. And some were instructed on the logical reasons why mass and volume are conserved across material transformations. Children's understanding of conservation was then assessed three times over 5 months. The results were discouraging. Children's understanding of conservation did not improve at any time under any form of instruction. Surprisingly, the instruction used in this study, as well as the instruction used in many other studies, lacked content about matter itself. Piaget characterized children's conservation errors as failures of logic, and accordingly, many psychologists have attempted to correct those errors with logic-based instruction. An alternative approach, however, is to focus on the causes of conservation, namely, that material substances are composed of smaller particles and that those particles can neither be created nor destroyed outside of a nuclear reaction. Any chemist asked to teach children about the conservation of matter would most likely start with molecules, not equivalence relations or quantitative invariants, and taking such an approach has indeed proven effective, as discussed later on. Thus, several decades after Piaget introduced the conservation task as a measure of children's logical reasoning, we now know that children fail that task not because they are illogical, but because they misunderstand the nature of matter. Atoms are the constituents of matter, comprising all solids, liquids, and gases. Do not trust atoms, warns one internet meme. They make up everything. Children cannot perceive atoms and are thus ignorant of their existence, as were all humans before the pioneering work of 19th century chemists like John Dalton, who discovered the principles of chemical synthesis, and J.J. Thomson, who discovered the electron. Nothing about our perceptual experience of matter would suggest that matter is particulate in nature. Much of the matter around us comes in discrete, bounded packages. Rocks, trees, logs, bricks, tables, chairs, shoes, hats, pencils, hammers. These objects betray no sign of their molecular composition. They appear continuous and holistic. In addition to being unaware of the microscopic components of macroscopic objects, we also misperceive the properties of those objects. All matter has weight and volume, but humans are not built to detect weight and volume. We are built to detect heft, felt weight, and bulk, visible volume. Heft differs from weight in that it conflates weight with density. Objects of the same weight can differ in heft if they also differ in density. Example, a 10-pound piece of steel feels heavier than a 10-pound piece of styrofoam. Bulk differs from volume in that bulk conflates volume with surface area. Objects of the same volume can differ in bulk if they also differ in surface area. Example, a blanket in a heap is bulkier than a blanket that is folded. The subjective nature of heft and bulk allows them to vary in ways that weight and volume do not. All matter has weight, but not all matter has heft. Example, snowflakes, dust. Likewise, all matter has volume, but not all matter has bulk. Example, helium, steam. This collection of perceptions, that matter is continuous, that matter has heft, that matter has bulk, forms the basis of children's first theory of matter, a holistic theory, eventually replaced in late adolescence by a particulate theory. Conservation errors are consistent with a holistic theory of matter in that changing the appearance of a substance, its height, its width, its spread, is deemed synonymous with changing the substance itself. But conservation errors are not the only evidence of holistic theories. Other evidence comes from children's judgments of what is matter and what is not. When asked whether solid objects are composed of matter, example, rocks, trees, logs, bricks, preschoolers and elementary schoolers unanimously agree that they are. They also agree that non-solid substances are composed of matter if those substances can be seen and touched. Example, water, salt, juice, jelly. But they vacillate on whether less tangible material substances, examples, dust, clouds, ink blots, bubbles, are composed of matter. They also vacillate on whether visible yet immaterial entities, examples, shadows, rainbows, lightning, sunshine, are composed of matter. Children are particularly confused about air. They know that air is all around them and that they take air into their lungs, but they judge it as non-material. They also claim that air has no volume. For example, that the air inside an empty box takes up no space at all. Air defies the very core of children's holistic theories of matter, as it has volume that cannot be seen, no bulk, and weight that cannot be felt, no heft. Children's holistic theories are also evident from their predictions of sinking and floating. The primary determinant of whether an object will sink or float is its average density, but children have no sensory apparatus for gauging an object's density. They can only gauge heft and bulk, which leads to systematic patterns of error. In one study, 4-year-olds were shown blocks of varying weights and sizes and asked to predict whether each would sink or float. Most children adopted a criterion based on weight. They predicted that blocks under 100 grams would float and that blocks over 100 grams would sink, regardless of whether the density of those blocks was above or below the density of water. Thus, children's predictions were correct for light blocks with below-threshold densities and heavy blocks with above-threshold densities, but incorrect for light blocks with above-threshold densities and heavy blocks with below-threshold densities. Other studies have found that children can be prompted to integrate weight and size, thereby approximating density, but they rarely do so on their own. Density is simply not salient on a holistic theory of matter. An even purer demonstration of children's holistic theories comes from studies in which children are asked to contemplate a material transformation that would be impossible to perceive: microscopic division. Children are shown a piece of styrofoam and are asked to imagine what would happen to the styrofoam's mass, weight, and volume if it were halved ad infinitum. This interview between a researcher and a third grader illustrates how children younger than 10 typically respond. Researcher: Imagine it is possible to divide this tiny piece in half and in half again. If we kept dividing the tiny pieces in half and in half, would the styrofoam matter ever disappear completely? Child:
Yes, after a year it would stop. There wouldn't be anything left.
Researcher: Now imagine a tiny piece of styrofoam, so tiny that you couldn't see it. Would that tiny piece take up any space at all? Child:
No, because if you have really big things on a table and kept it in the corner, it wouldn't take up any space.
Researcher: Would that tiny piece have any weight? Child:
Nothing at all.
Researcher: 0 grams? Child:
Yes, because if you took a tiny piece off, it would just feel like your own skin because it doesn't weigh anything.
Notice how this child explicitly equates volume with bulk. The tiny piece could be kept in a corner, and weight with heft.
It would just feel like your skin.
Older children, in contrast, provide a qualitatively different pattern of results. Researcher: Imagine it is possible to divide this tiny piece in half and in half again. If we kept dividing the tiny pieces in half and in half, would the styrofoam matter ever disappear completely? Child:
Half of that is still something, and half of that is very, very tiny, but it's still something. There's no one object that half of it is nothing.
Researcher: If we kept dividing the tiny pieces in half and in half again, would we ever get to a piece that does not take up any space? Child:
No. No matter how tiny it is, as long as it's matter, it takes up space.
Researcher: Would we ever get to a piece that has no weight? Child:
It would be unmeasurable, but it would have weight. If a tiny person tried to pick it up, it would have weight to him.
This sixth grader clearly views matter as indestructible, attributing weight and volume to matter even when that matter is too small to be seen. She was inclined to identify weight with heft, like the child in the previous example, but she recognized that her own perception of heft, or lack thereof, was irrelevant to whether the object still had weight, hence the appeal to a tiny person. One final source of evidence for holistic theories is the confusion that children experience as they begin to learn about gases, typically in middle school. Middle schoolers might accept that gases are composed of matter, but they have trouble connecting the macroscopic properties of gases to microscopic particles. Children initially construe gases as holistic, homogeneous entities, just as they initially construed solids. This notion leads them to deny that gas particles are in constant motion, that gas particles are separated by empty space, and that the spacing of gas particles depends on the volume of the gas as a whole. Many adults deny these ideas as well. We may know a lot of things about the relation between a solid's macroscopic properties example buoyancy, and its microscopic properties, example density, but we have yet to learn those ideas anew for gases. Children's understanding of matter is an outgrowth of infants' understanding of matter, and for many years, psychologists believed that infants had no such understanding at all. Infants were thought to lack object permanence, or the insight that objects continue to exist even when they are out of view. The development of object permanence appeared to be slow and protracted. Below 4 months of age, infants make no attempts to reach for a desired object when that object is hidden behind a screen or under a cloth. Between 4 and 8 months, infants retrieve an object that is partly hidden from view, but they will not attempt to retrieve an object fully hidden from view. Between 8 and 12 months, infants will retrieve objects that are fully hidden, but they make a curious error if those objects are hidden in the same location for several trials, location A, and then switch to a new location, location B. They search for the object in the old location before switching to the new location, a behavior known as the A not B error. Finally, between 12 and 18 months, infants come to retrieve objects that are hidden from view, regardless of whether those objects were hidden in the same location on previous trials or in a different location. The development of object permanence was first charted by Piaget, the same psychologist who discovered conservation errors. He concluded that infants have no innate appreciation of the permanence of matter, let alone the conservation of matter, but they develop such an appreciation over the first year of life. The problem with this conclusion is that it was based on data that conflate two types of errors, conceptual errors and motor errors. Infants may fail to retrieve hidden objects because they have forgotten their existence, a conceptual error, but they may also fail to do so because they are unable to execute a successful reach, a motor error. Watching a 10-month-old infant make the A not B error conveys the strong impression that the failure is a motor error, not a conceptual error, because infants who search for objects in the wrong location often look to the correct one. Their eyes reveal knowledge that their hands seemingly cannot act on. One way to disentangle conceptual errors from motor errors is to use different methods to assess infants' expectations about objects, methods that don't require the motor skills of physically retrieving an object. Such a method was devised in the 1970s, near the end of Piaget's life, and is known as preferential looking. This method takes advantage of the fact that infants, like everyone else, look longer at unexpected events, example, one object passing through another, than at expected events, example, one object bumping into another. By measuring how long infants look at one set of events compared with another, psychologists have discovered that infants hold rich and varied expectations long before they are able to act on those expectations, let alone articulate them. In one famous study, the researchers familiarized 5-month-old infants with a rectangular screen that pivoted on its bottom edge, rotating back and forth like a fan. The researchers then placed a small box behind the screen, out of view of the infant, and the infant watched one of two events. Either the screen stopped prematurely in its path, seemingly making contact with the box, still hidden behind the screen, or the screen continued on its path as before, seemingly passing through the box. An adult watching these two events would be surprised by the second event, but unsurprised by the first, and would thus look longer at the second event than at the first. Infants do the same. They look longer at the second event than at the first, which implies that they are surprised by the second event, but not by the first. This finding implies not only that infants expect objects to collide on contact rather than pass through one another, but also that they keep track of objects hidden from view, making predictions about the behavior of visible objects, the moving screen, on the basis of their interactions with non-visible objects, the box. Young infants thus demonstrate object permanence long before they are able to retrieve objects with their hands. In fact, infants expect a hidden box to interrupt the trajectory of a moving screen by just 3 months of age. Infants of this age also expect objects to move on contact with other objects and to trace continuous paths as they move. When shown violations of these events, for example, objects moving on their own without being contacted by other objects, or objects blipping in and out of existence, infants stare in disbelief. Such events are, of course, impossible, but wily researchers have figured out how to stage them using trick apparatuses or sleight of hand. Thus, contrary to what Piaget had thought, infants do hold expectations about objects, expectations that we continue to hold as adults. Infants do not, however, hold expectations about less cohesive forms of matter, like salt or sand. Their expectations about solidity, continuity, and contact are triggered only by discrete, bounded objects. In one study, 8-month-old infants were tested on whether they could keep track of two types of entities deposited behind an opaque screen: piles of sand and solid objects that looked like piles of sand but moved cohesively. They were chunks of styrofoam with sand glued to them. In the sand condition, the researchers poured one pile of sand behind the screen and then another. The screen was then lowered, revealing either two piles of sand or one. The infants looked equally long at both outcomes, indicating that they had no expectation about how many piles of sand should be behind the screen. In the object condition, infants watched the researchers place one object behind the screen and then another. The screen was then lowered, revealing either two objects or one. Now the infants looked reliably longer at the latter, indicating that they had expected both objects to continue to exist behind the screen. The researchers worried that even though infants in the sand condition saw two instances of pouring at two locations, they may have been uncertain whether the sand ended up in one pile or two. The researchers thus ran another experiment in which they poured sand behind two screens rather than one, screens separated by a 16-centimeter gap. When the screens were lowered, revealing either two piles of sand or one, the infants again looked equally long at both outcomes. They were not tracking the location of the sand in the way they had tracked the location of objects, even though the objects were designed to look identical to the sand in a sand pile. Human infants are not the only primates that track cohesive forms of matter but fail to track non-cohesive ones. When the studies described before were repeated with lemurs, the results were the same. Lemurs form precise expectations about the number of objects behind a screen, but no expectations about the number of sand piles behind a screen. Evolution seems to have equipped primates with the ability to track objects, but not the ability to track less cohesive forms of matter. We can trace the identity of objects as they move through space, go out of view, or come into contact with other objects, but we can't even count piles of sand, at least not as infants. Of course, the abilities conferred to us by evolution are those that proved useful in furthering our survival and reproduction, and it's hard to see how tracking non-cohesive substances would meet that criterion. We need to consume non-cohesive substances for nourishment, milk and water in particular, but we do not need to track those substances across displacement and space, nor do we need to perceive a connection between them and other material entities like solid objects. Conceiving of a rock as a bounded entity capable of being lifted, carried, thrown, or hidden is infinitely more valuable to survival than conceiving of it as fundamentally similar to sand. So if we begin life thinking of matter as fundamentally holistic, how do we come to conceive of it as particulate? Telling children that matter is made up of particles is not particularly helpful because they are not prepared to engage with this information. They must first reorganize their understanding of matter, collapsing distinctions that are meaningful on a holistic theory but not a particulate theory, and creating distinctions that are meaningful on a particulate theory but not a holistic theory. For instance, children must collapse the distinction between objects and non-cohesive substances, coming to see both as matter. And they need to create distinctions between their perception of weight, heft, and the physical definition of weight, and between their perception of volume, bulk, and the physical definition of volume. Only then can they entertain the concept of density, or weight per unit volume. Density is, in a single property, the embodiment of a particulate theory. Only something with internal structure could be characterized as densely packed or loosely packed. But that structure is imperceptible to the naked eye, and accordingly, young children have no conception of density separate from weight. They do not use density to predict buoyancy, as discussed before, nor do they use density to differentiate types of materials. Consider the following task. You are given three blocks of metal, a block of lead measuring 1 inch per side and weighing 6.5 ounces, another block of lead measuring 3 inches per side and weighing 19.6 ounces, and a block of aluminum measuring 5 inches per side and weighing 7.8 ounces, and you are asked to determine which two blocks are made from the same type of metal. The blocks are covered in contact paper, so you can't use color as a clue. What would you do? You would probably compare each block's weight to its size, realizing that the largest block, the aluminum block, is not as heavy for its size as the other two blocks, the lead blocks. Preschoolers and young elementary schoolers find this task surprisingly difficult. They can discern which block is an outlier in terms of weight and which block is an outlier in terms of volume, but they cannot discern which block is an outlier in terms of weight per unit volume. Most children end up basing their judgments strictly on weight, pairing the 6.5 ounce lead block with the 7.8 ounce aluminum block. This mystery material task was devised by the psychologist Carol Smith and her colleagues. Smith has studied children's intuitive theories of matter for over three decades. Most of her studies have centered on the concept of density, as children's understanding of density is a good metric of their understanding of matter in general. One approach that Smith has taken to teaching density, or mass per unit volume, is to analogize this imperceptible quantity to per unit quantities that can be perceived. Pressure, for instance, is a per unit quantity that can be detected by our skin, force per unit area. Tempo is per unit quantity that can be detected by our ears, beats per unit time. Concentration is a per unit quantity that can be detected by our tongue, molecules per unit volume. And crowdedness is a per unit quantity that can be detected by our eyes, objects per unit area. In one study, Smith introduced the concept of density by way of two other per unit concepts, concentration and crowdedness. She and her colleagues taught seventh graders how to differentiate the variables that enter into each per unit quantity by having them solve two hypothetical murders. In the first murder, the victim drank poisoned Kool-Aid, and the children had to determine which suspect had prepared the Kool-Aid. They had to compare its concentration with the concentration of each suspect's preferred recipe for Kool-Aid, that is, the suspect's preferred amount of Kool-Aid mix per unit water. In the second murder, the victim ate a poisoned chocolate chip cookie, and children had to determine which suspect had baked the cookie. To figure this out, the kids compared the crowdedness of the cookie's chips to the crowdedness of chips in each suspect's preferred recipe for chocolate chip cookies, that is, the preferred number of chips per unit batter. Smith assessed her students' understanding of concentration, crowdedness, and density by asking them to order, in increasing magnitude, solutions of different concentration, dot arrays of different crowdedness, and materials of different density, where each per unit quantity was specified with easily computable values, like 4 teaspoons of sugar to 2 cups of water. Before the murder mystery curriculum, The students were able to order the dot arrays by crowdedness, but were unable to order the solutions by concentration or the materials by density. After the curriculum, students were then able to order the solutions by concentration, but they were still unable to order the materials by density. The conceptual gap between the training quantities, crowdedness and concentration, and the target quantity, density, was just too great. In follow-up studies, Smith and her colleagues took a different approach. Rather than attempt to render density perceptible, they introduced students to material phenomena that were themselves perceptible, but could only be explained in terms of density and its constituent variables, weight and volume. Over several weeks, students weighed objects too small to have heft, a fleck of glitter, a dot of ink, on a highly sensitive scale. They compared empty balloons to air-filled balloons on a balance scale. They deduced the volume of objects too small to measure with a ruler, one drop of water, from the volume of measurable quantities, 1 milliliter of water. They immersed objects of varying densities in liquids of varying densities. They measured the weight and volume of an iron ball before and after heating it. And they measured the weight of Alka-Seltzer tablets before and after vaporizing them. Unlike the murder mystery curriculum, this curriculum proved effective. Few students were able to order materials by density before the curriculum, but most could do so afterward. Likewise, few students categorized intangible substances, air, dust, smoke, as matter, or attributed weight to microscopic objects, a tiny piece of styrofoam, before the curriculum, but most did so afterward. Perhaps most noteworthy, students who failed Piaget's conservation tasks before the curriculum passed those tasks after the curriculum, even though the topic of conservation was never specifically addressed. Additional research by Smith and her colleagues has revealed that acquiring a particulate theory of matter has surprisingly widespread consequences, consequences that extend beyond the domain of matter and into the domain of number. Integers, like objects, can be divided into smaller components, fractions. Yet children do not initially think of integers this way. They think of them simply as the endpoints of counting. Young children understand that numbers can be increased or decreased by adding objects to the sets they label or removing objects from those sets. But young children have no idea that numbers can be divided. Numbers are seen as holistic and homogeneous, similar to physical objects. Intrigued by this parallel, Smith and her colleagues investigated whether understanding the divisibility of number develops in tandem with understanding the divisibility of matter. They did so by pairing the styrofoam division task described before with a number division task. Here's a sample interview with a third grader. Researcher: Are there any numbers between 0 and 1? Child:
No.
Researcher: How about 1/2? Child:
Yes, I think so.
Researcher: About how many numbers are there between 0 and 1?
Child: A little, just 0 and 1/2, because it's halfway to 1.
Researcher: Suppose you divided 2 in 1/2 and got 1. And then divided that number in 1/2. Could you keep dividing forever?
Child: No, because if you just took that half a number, that would be 0, and you can't divide 0.
Researcher: Would you ever get to 0?
Child: Yes.
Some third graders knew of the existence of fractions other than just 1/2. One third grader, for instance, noted,
There's 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, 1/something, all the way up to 10.
But they denied that these fractions could themselves be divided. Older children, on the other hand, claimed not only that a fraction like 1/4 could be divided in half, but also that it could be divided in half ad infinitum, as illustrated in this conversation with a fifth grader. Researcher: Are there any numbers between 0 and 1?
Child:
Yes.
Researcher: Can you give an example?
Child:
1/2 or 0.5.
Researcher:
About how many numbers are there between 0 and 1?
Child:
A lot.
Researcher: Suppose you divided 2 in half and got 1, and then divided that number in half. Could you keep dividing forever?
Child:
Yes. There always has to be something left when you divide it.
Researcher: Would you ever get to 0?
Child:
No, because there is an infinite number of numbers below 1 and above 0.
Critically, children's understanding of the divisibility of number tracks their understanding of the divisibility of matter. Children who claim that numbers cease to exist at some point in division also claim that material substances cease to have weight at some point in division, whereas children who claim that numbers continue to exist claim that material substances continue to have weight as well. Still, if one insight lags behind the other, it's the insight that numbers are infinitely divisible, meaning that children grasp the notion of infinite divisibility for material entities, objects, before they do so for immaterial entities, numbers. Developing a more sophisticated understanding of matter may thus be a stepping stone to developing a more sophisticated understanding of number. Infinite divisibility and infinite density are crucial insights that can be transferred from one domain to the other. Highlighting these parallels is actually a highly productive strategy for teaching fractions and other types of rational number, like decimals and percentages. Students taught to associate fractions with the amount of a container filled with water, a substance, fare much better than those taught to associate fractions with pieces of a pie, objects. Objects may be useful for learning integers, as both are discrete, bounded, and unitary, but substances are more useful for learning fractions, as both are continuous, divisible, and dense. The parallels between number and matter run deeper across domains than within. Which is heavier, a pound of feathers or a pound of gold? Neither, of course. A pound is a pound. But the question likely gave you pause. Gold is heftier than feathers, and our conceptions of heft interfere with our conceptions of weight. Heft and bulk are perceptual experiences of matter that do not change with our conceptual understanding of matter. They interfere with our reasoning about material phenomena throughout our lives. Take the task of deciding whether an object will sink or float in water. We adults are quick to judge that large, dense objects, example, an iron pan, will sink, and that light, airy objects, example, a styrofoam packing peanut, will float. But we are slow to judge that light yet dense objects, example, a fleck of iron, will sink, and heavy yet airy objects, example, a styrofoam crate, will float. Even though we may recognize that density is the only dimension relevant to such judgments, heft and bulk still interfere. Heft and bulk interfere with our ability to discriminate material entities from non-material entities as well. When asked to classify entities as matter or not matter as quickly as possible, we take longer to classify intangible substances, ink blots, perfume, air, as matter than we do to classify tangible ones, rocks, bricks, shoes. And when we err, our errors are consistent with children's errors on untimed versions of the task. In one speeded classification study, adults classified ink blots as matter only 85% of the time, perfume as matter only 83% of the time, and air as matter only 75% of the time. Conversely, they classified thunder as matter 35% of the time, starlight as matter 37% of the time, and lightning as matter 57% of the time. Even Antoine Lavoisier, the founder of modern chemistry, was confused about the physical status of heat and light. He classified both as elements of matter. We need not be under time pressure to err in our material reasoning. We err in casual situations as well. For instance, we put full bottles of water in the freezer, forgetting that they will explode when the water inside expands beyond the volume of the bottle. We pay higher prices for larger packages of food, failing to consider whether the amount of food per unit of package is equivalent across packages of different sizes. We overexert ourselves when clearing snow from our driveways, failing to see how a collection of heftless snowflakes could yield hundreds of pounds of frozen water. And we quibble over whether a glass is half empty or half full, when in reality it's full all the way, one part with liquid and one part with gas. My favorite everyday example of a matter-based blunder comes from the pub. A standard pint glass is 5.875 inches tall and has a diameter of 3.25 inches at its top and 2.375 inches at its bottom. How much beer would you estimate is missing from a glass that is filled to 5 inches rather than the full 5.875 inches? Nearly a quarter. A 15% decrement in height yields a 25% decrement in volume, thanks to the fact that standard pint glass is tapered, and tapered glasses hold more beer at their top than at their bottom. Most of us are oblivious to how much beer we are missing when served a less than full glass, but now that obliviousness is avoidable. An entrepreneurial beer drinker has invented a pocket-sized device for measuring the decrement in beer volume for every decrement in beer height, available for purchase at thebeergauge.com. Its name rings true to its heritage, the Piaget Beer Gauge.